but winds up to 35 miles per hour. 25 on Saturday, single digits Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. Currently, 27 Racine, 28 Kenosha, wind chill minus 4. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today is the monthly visit of Kaylin Palomares. She was originally scheduled to actually be part of the morning show last Thursday, but as many of you know, the state funeral for former U.S. President Jimmy Carter was that morning, and so we abbreviated that program, and rather than rush through what Kaylin had planned, we both agreed it made more sense to postpone that until today. And Kaylin is actually invited to the program today two friends who are also working in the field of, let's say, environmental science in two different, very different capacities. The connection between the two is that they are both graduates of the Environmental Studies program at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And so we will be more properly introducing Tiffany Wagner and Maddie Kammerer in just a moment. But first, Kaylin Palomares, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
So, did anything in particular prompt you to want to issue this invitation and put a conversation like this together?
Yeah, I was feeling a little bit, I was just kind of thinking about my time at Parkside a little bit and kind of how important that was to me and how much I enjoyed it. And so I was trying to think of people that I've heard of or that I knew from my time at Parkside that have gone on to do things in, with the same degree that I have, to kind of show the broad nature of our degree. So I first thought of Tiffany because Tiffany and I were in the environmental club together, and she actually was president after I graduated. So we were together quite a bit during that time. And then Maddie, I kind of know through the grapevine. She graduated a little bit before we did, but she has made a good name for herself as well. So I figured these would be two really good representatives of the program at Parkside. So
it sounds like it. So Kaylin, when did you graduate from Parkside?
I graduated in May of 2021.
Okay, so the same time as Tiffany.
I was just one extra semester, so December 2021.
Gotcha, very good. And Kaylin, was your major also in environmental studies?
Yes, it was.
Very good. As was Tiffany Wagner, class of 21 plus a semester, so to speak. And then Maddie Kammerer, a little bit earlier, graduate of 2020, correct?
Yeah.
Very good. Glad to have each of you here. And Kaylin, I think part of what made this invitation make sense is that we're talking about two different people working with environmental causes in two different, very different ways,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So let's hear a little bit about, first of all, Tiffany Wagner, who is an environmental scientist at Riekert and Mielke, which I think is located in Waukesha.
Yeah.
But your scope of operation, I think, is certainly wider than that. And then Maddie Kammerer, you are a natural resources specialist at USDA Natural Resource Conservation Service. And where is that headquartered?
So I'm based out of Juneau, Wisconsin, but I cover the southeast area of Wisconsin.
Very good. Well, we appreciate both of you being here. Maybe ahead of talking about what you currently do, let's find out a little bit about what drew each of you just into your kind of general interest in the environment and prompted you to want to actually study environmental sciences in the way that you did at Parkside. Let's start with Tiffany.
Yeah, thank you. So, I mean, I think my background's probably a little bit less traditional in that I didn't know that I always wanted to do this. I actually kind of where I thought I was heading, and then when I went to Parkside, I kind of decided I wanted to take kind of a plethora of classes, take gen ed, see what was out there, and so I took an intro to environmental studies class, and, you know, growing up, I, you know, on the lake in Racine area, and so always had love for Lake Michigan, and my parents were had a good emphasis on, like, camping and spending time outside, so kind of the environmental and natural science world was always important to me, and so when I took that first class, it was kind of like a no-brainer kind of moment where I just realized I didn't know that this was something I could do, and so that kind of is where I got drew me to it.
And it sounds like maybe you didn't even realize how much you were interested in it.
Yeah, yeah.
Or what sort of an affinity you had.
Yeah.
Who was the teacher of that transformative class?
I think it was Laura Schultz for the intro class, yeah.
Very good. How about you, Maddie?
So I kind of always knew I wanted to go into working into the outdoors in some way, shape, or form. Growing up, my childhood, my parents were always like, oh, if you're having a bad day, go outside. If you're bored, go outside. So I've always just kind of been used to going outside and being outside, and we definitely spent a lot of time outside as a family, like visiting state parks. And I'm from Illinois, so I came up to Wisconsin and visited Parkside, and I loved the campus. I loved the parks that were nearby, the lake. And so I kind of already had in mind that I wanted to do environmental science, and then kind of, yeah, once I took the intro classes, I was like, oh, yeah, definitely taking this. Love that.
This is it. Kaylin, how about you? I don't know that I necessarily know your own story of what sort of perked your curiosity, your interest, and also what drew you to UW Parkside.
Yeah, as a child, I, for some reason, really wanted to be a meteorologist. So that was up until, like, 7th, 8th grade, that was what I was going to do. And then I started losing that because I didn't like math. I was really bad at math. So I was like, I'm going to be an actor. I'm going to be a dental hygienist. I'm going to be a this, that, and the other. I was very lost. And then my senior year of high school, I was helping out TAing for my, like, ecology teacher and horticulture teacher, and I was helping her make plans for her classes, and that was very exciting to me. And so I didn't know that you could do this for a job either, or with your life, go to college for it, until she kind of told me. So I did an internship at the Racine Zoo my senior year of high school, and then that kind of solidified it. And I chose Parkside because it was very close by, and again, it's beautiful, and I'm very happy with my choice. I had an amazing time at Parkside, and once I started with environmental studies there, I kept that the whole time. I never changed it.
Very good. Found your way. For those of you just joining us, today is Kaylin Palomares' monthly visit to the morning show, and with her are two fellow alumni of the University of Wisconsin Parkside, Tiffany Wagner and Maddie Kammerer. Since you all have UW Parkside environmental studies in common, it would probably make sense for us to take a little bit of time to just talk about what that means. I mean, what that program of study looks like, the kind of things you explore, and also if within that major are there different options? I mean, are there decisions you can make in terms of different tracks to follow? I mean, what does environmental studies look like at Parkside?
I would just say that each of us are probably going to say something probably much different, because there are different concentrations within the program at Parkside, so I believe there's, like, a policy, there's a biology,
geography, geoscience, and I think maybe general.
Yeah, so I did general. So mine was very broad, so I touched on, you know, agriculture, I touched on ecology, I touched on botany, I touched on climate change, you know, all the different areas, which is kind of a blessing and a curse in a way, because I never really, like, zeroed in on one thing that I wanted to, like, be good at, like, the one thing that I'm good at. So I had a very kind of, I like to call it a sample platter of the program, but both of these guys might have a different answer for that.
Great. So this is Tiffany.
Yeah. So I did actually geoscience. That was my focus. But originally I was general as well, but unfortunately struggled a little bit with the chemistry and biology classes. So I ended up kind of stepping away from the general and going towards geoscience, since that was where I had done a majority of my classes. It kind of piqued my interest the most. So that was a lot of my schooling. So I feel like I was mostly doing classes, you know, out on the pike and kind of doing that. I didn't really have as much of ecology and that side of things.
I honestly don't have a terribly good grasp of the term geoscience. And if I don't, I suspect there's some listeners as well that maybe don't understand what that term really comprises or what is encapsulated there.
Yeah, so I don't know that I'm the best explainer either, since I've kind of stepped kind of away from that too. But so
sure.
Geology, the study of rocks and the formation of Earth, and so all of that sort of thing. And at Parkside, it was Dr. Rachel Headley, and so she had a glacial kind of background. So it was kind of like a weird niche group too, where we did like a lot of like glaciology stuff like that, whereas probably a lot of universities maybe don't focus on that so much.
Great. How about you, Maddie?
The environmental geography route, so kind of more of the cartography and studying of maps, but then I also added a GIS minor, which has helped me a lot in my current line of work, so a lot of mapping and map making and surveying, so I enjoyed that route, and I think it definitely helped with what I do now.
So explain what the term GIS refers to.
GIS is Geographic Information System, so it's basically a program, a computer program, where you can take data that you collect out in the field and then add it to that program and create maps from that. You can make all kinds of maps. They use it in all different lines of work. I know, obviously, major environmental work, they use GIS, but like law enforcement, I mean, crime rates and stuff, so they use GIS all over.
And what is it that drew you to want to focus your studies in that particular way?
Didn't have to take many chemistry classes.
So a fear of chemistry is a big theme in the room.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
I had to push through the chemistry myself, and that was tough, but yeah, and the biology as well, I had to push through. So.
Interesting. So each of you are doing different things, which we're going to be exploring in the next few minutes. So this isn't that. I just want to know a little more generally. Upon your graduation, again, Tiffany in December of 21, Maddie in May, I assume, of 2020. Oh, you're a COVID grad. and Tiffany, to some extent, too, you both certainly felt that disruption. But upon graduation, did you, at that point, have a really good sense of what you hoped to do? Or was that quite a big unknown as you were in your cap and gown?
I think I knew, obviously, you know, that I wanted to be in, obviously, in the environmental field in some aspect, but I was just very open. Like you said, it was kind of COVID times. There wasn't a lot out there when I graduated, so I kind of was open to any and every opportunity that there was out there. So it was pretty unknown for me at that time, yeah.
Right. And did you end up taking the position that you have right now? I mean, was that essentially the first major job you found after graduation?
Yeah.
Very good. And again, you're at Rekert and Mielke, and we're going to be talking about that in a moment. Maddie, how about you?
Yeah, so when I graduated in 2020, I didn't have a ceremony or anything. Yeah, the job market was pretty tough when I graduated, but I ended up getting a job at a private consulting firm doing a lot of field work. So I did that for about 2 years, and I think that definitely, I realized I wanted to be with more people, be in a job that was kind of a team aspect. I did cross country and track at Parkside, and so I really enjoyed being around people and being on a team, and so that was not for me. The private route was not for me. I could not do the long days alone, so I definitely was just needing a job that was in the field to get some experience on my resume, and then when I could switch over to something a little more up my alley, I did.
Maddie Kammerer, I would like you to clarify one thing, and that is just what exactly the connection is between the making of maps and the whole field of environmental studies. And you touched on a really intriguing possibility, which is that there are all kinds of different maps that can be made, not just the Rand McNally thing you used to have in your glove compartment before GPS. But I mean, explain kind of the wider world of map making and how it relates to what we're talking about today.
Yeah, so in my current field, which is like conservation agriculture, we use a lot of GIS made maps to just kind of show like the conservation plans that we're putting together. So we'll put like practices on maps that we're planning out for, and then we'll give those to them, the farmers or the producers, so they can have a better gauge. Obviously they know what their land looks like and where certain things are, but it's also just a nice visual to be able to say, hey, we want you to plant trees here in this spacing or like this amount of trees. So we use GIS a lot in at least my line of field, to make maps for people just as a better visual of where we want things to go, and kind of like shaping. If it's an odd shape, we can go out and GIS maps, and like we can take a unit out and kind of survey those points and bring it back to the office, so we have like an exact shape of something if it's like a weird tree that juts out on a field line. But we also, we have a lot of maps that we already have for us, because Farm Service Agency, they provide a lot of really, really good maps for us that we use a lot. So we kind of will take those maps and add to them with our own data that we collected. And then we have a lot of just maps that we need to make to submit for projects. So like if there's wildfire risk, we make maps like that. Obviously there's not too much of a risk down in southeastern Wisconsin, but we use GIS for a lot of different aspects.
Yeah. And I guess one thing you're touching on that I think doesn't occur to a lot of us is that for most of us, where the most of our experience with maps, holding a map in our hands, is a map of something that's already there.
Right.
I mean, like, where is that next town, and where does this road go? And what you're talking about is using map making, I suppose, kind of the way an architect uses blueprints.
Right.
So
yeah.
it's sometimes to maybe articulate a vision for how you hope a plot of land is going to be reshaped.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. Yeah. Very good. So let's talk for a little bit about the specific work that each of you is doing. Again, today is Kaylin Palomares' monthly visit to the morning show, and she has brought with her two friends and colleagues, if you will, both graduates of the University of Wisconsin Parkside, as is Kaylin. Tiffany Wagner, from the class of 21, who is an environmental scientist at Reichert and Mielke, and Maddie Kammerer from the class of 2020, a natural resources specialist at USDA Natural Resource Conservation Service. So there's probably a bit of overlap in some ways, and yet also some really distinct things about what each of you are doing. Tiffany, let's start with you and about this firm for which you work that's based in Waukesha, Reichert and Mielke. Tell us, first of all, in general, what this firm is all about, and then your specific role within it.
Yeah, so I am an environmental scientist at Reichert Mielke, and so they are a civil engineering firm, and so, you know, mostly municipal water, wastewater projects, working a lot with municipalities is kind of their main focus. And so I'm on the environmental team, which is a little bit newer, and so we mostly are like an internal service to all of our projects that are ongoing, making sure that all of our clients and projects, that the projects meet different environmental regulations, as well as like help clients with other stuff, stormwater permit compliance, wetland waterway permitting, stuff like that.
So tell us how the connection is typically made. I mean, are municipalities coming to you, or state agencies coming to you? I mean, who is actually knocking on your door, so to speak, in terms of seeking your services?
Yeah, so the clients are mostly municipalities, public cities, villages, towns, as well as some private as well, but mostly public municipalities will reach out with projects that, you know, you go out for, and then if you get them, then kind of where we would step in is, you know, you have this project, and so you're going to look at it and see what potential environmental impacts there would be.
So is this then a case where a given municipality wants to do something or is being directed to do something, and then you are one of the, in a sense, consulting firms that come in and help them sort of sort out some of the specifics of that?
Yeah.
And can you be more specific when you talk about environmental impact? What are what are you talking about?
Yeah, so well, I work mostly with engineers. So what would happen is, you know, a municipality would put out a project, and whatever that project, maybe it's like a water main replacement or a pathway, and, you know, different firms would put in, they would put in their proposals, and then, you know, if we would get it, then the engineers will be working on it, and usually they would come to one of us on the environmental team and say, you know, here's where this project is. Can you look at it and see what's all there? So, you know, we would look at it and say, does it look like there might be wetlands on site? Does it look like there's a stream in the project area? You know, kind of do super high level. Is there, we could look at if there's any known archaeological sites that are mapped in databases, or hazardous waste sites nearby, kind of just like anything that may cause, you know, things that you would need to avoid during the project.
So you are in the business of troubleshooting, at least among other things. I mean, trying to sort out what could go wrong here or what are the potential hazards.
Yeah.
So, Caitlin, I'm curious how this overlaps with the work that you do for Racine County. I mean, would Racine County conceivably seek out the services of a firm like Rickard and Mielke?
Maybe. But the thing is, with the county, we kind of oversee any of the municipalities that are unincorporated. So like, Village of Sturtevant or Mount Pleasant, for instance, like, they are big enough that they have kind of some of their own staff and their own funding to do things like that. So, say, Microsoft, for instance.
Mm.
The Racine County doesn't even really have much to do, like, me as a staff, we don't have much to do at all with that project because it's Mount Pleasant. But if that was happening in Dover or in, like, the village of Burlington, and or the town of Burlington, I'm sorry, then, you know, we'd have a little bit more say in what's going on. And so, with that said, she's kind of doing some of the things that I'm doing. So in the unincorporated areas, if there's a project, I'm going out, I'm doing a review of that project, seeing what kind of issues there are, mostly focusing on like water sources and erosion issues. But those municipalities might not have a me on staff. And so that's why they are, you know, going out and they're hiring an agency to do something like that.
Right. So if they don't have Kaylin Palomares, then they need to seek out Tiffany Wagner.
Yes.
So I noticed on your website that one of the projects that your firm was involved in involved Racine. What was that now? I took some notes here. Racine Water and Wastewater Utility.
Yeah.
I saw a reference to that. What is that particular project, and would you have had anything to do with that?
No, I probably wouldn't have. I mean, I don't know. We do work with Racine Water and Wastewater Utility. I'm not involved so much in the wastewater side of things, and there have been a couple big projects, some that were prior to my time, so I'm not exactly sure which one it was, and I may or may not have done a few things for
sure.
It.
Sure. So when you are involved in a given project, first of all, it sounds like you physically go there, like you go to the site where this work is potentially going to be done. What would your investigation, if we want to call it that, what would that sort of look like, and what kinds of things would you do in terms of trying to gather the information that you need to make some helpful, solid recommendations?
Yeah, so usually, actually, we always kind of start with desktop assessments. So sometimes the environmental team may not even have to go out on site if we can figure out enough stuff from desktop. But like, for example, if we looked at a site and it looked like DNR has a mapping viewer that shows mapped wetlands and hydric soils. So if we looked at a site and said, you know, there's hydric soils, there looks like there's low spots in topography, then we would, we have an assured wetland delineator on our team. So we would reach out to him, and I assist him sometimes. So then we would go out there and we would look at what DNR has mapped for hydric soils and wetlands. And then we would perform a wetland delineation, so looking at the soil, looking at plants, and then we would actually take survey equipment and map it. So kind of tying back to Maddie's experience with GIS, we would, you know, go out there. If there were any wetlands, we would map them, bring them, survey them, bring them back, and, you know, make a map for a client to know that, you know, there are wetlands on site that you will have to, you know, avoid.
So part of what you would be doing then is just saying, This part of this parcel of land is wetlands, and because of current state statutes, I guess, those cannot be touched or those cannot be adversely affected.
Right, so yeah, they could either be avoided, or, you know, you could work with DNR with different wetland permits for activities that are permitted, things like that.
But it sounds like you're also in the business of, if something is done, what could the consequences be? I mean, is that also part of what, if something gets changed, what could happen? Is that part of what you also are trying to assess, or is that left to others?
Yeah, that's more kind of like the state agency and regulation side of things. So, you know, obviously we would make recommendations of what to do or, you know, what you can't do, but then wouldn't be involved in, you know, we would never want to give advice, you know, against regulations, so that's kind of onto that.
Right. So when you are assessing exactly where the boundary of wetlands is, I'm assuming that's something that, I mean, just to the naked eye, even perhaps at a glance, you can often tell that, oh yeah, this looks like wetlands over here.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not just interested in that. You are interested in exactly where this is, and you're probably assessing things that are not easily visible to the eye, or it's not just by looking at things that you know.
Right, correct, yeah.
So what kinds of things do you specifically investigate then?
So I guess like a good example for like a confusing site could be like a lot of agricultural fields. Like I think that both Maddie and Kaylin probably could agree. It would be hard to tell if you looked at, you know, a farm field that there's a wetland there, because you see corn growing, you see all the, you see this vegetation there, and so it doesn't look like a wetland to, you know, a farmer or to anyone else. So then, you know, going out there and looking at the soil, and then, you know, kind of doing like a deeper look at the past and history, and maybe you see that there was a spot where like the crops normally like stressed or drowned out, and those sort of things where it might not seem like a wetland, but like when you look further, then you know that if, you know, if it weren't farmed, that it probably would stay back to being a wetland.
Can I add, I just want to say something that I learned through this job was that a wetland in your mind is not always what a wetland actually is. So in your mind you think cattails and pretty flowers and frogs and things like that, but sometimes it's literally just wet land. It's just land that stays wet to a point for a period of the year. And so that's something that I think commonly isn't known either, mm-hmm. which I see a wetland before, I'd see that as like this beautiful, you know, habitat type of area, but it's not always the case. So that's why people like these guys are necessary, to show like, no, there is wetland here, and it could be that beautiful vision in your head of what you think a wetland would be, but right now it's wet dirt.
Right, exactly. So. And again, especially in many farm fields, I'm sure that kind of thing you don't immediately know.
Until we have a year like this where it was super, super wet and half the farm fields are flooded out and none of their beans or their corn are growing, and it's because historically that area was a wetland. And it will kind of always be that way unless you do some really, really hardcore work on the land. So
it's always going to be prone to that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Interesting. So Tiffany, you are mostly interested in this is a wetland right now. Kaylin just touched on something about like the possibility that this used to be a wetland, or it's really meant to be a wetland, or you were kind of implying that, right?
Yeah,
I mean, that the lay of the land.
In my head, a wetland is always a wetland now. That's what it should be and what it's meant to be. But, yeah, that's not how everyone views it, and not how every even, you know, municipality or person would view it. So that could vary. But it's my understanding that Tiffany is figuring out both. Like, this should be a wetland, or it is technically a wetland, even though there's just, you know, used up soil here.
Right. Well, because we hear about wetland restoration,
right.
Which implies that wetlands can be, in a sense, destroyed or removed or
mm-hmm.
drastically altered from their natural state. And so are you mostly interested in the here and now, or are you also interested in, I mean, potentially in your work, are you sometimes looking at this area once was a wetland or should be a wetland?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my work is more of the consulting side. So, you know, what is there now? We do have done some projects in the past that were like stream restoration projects that do include a portion of wetland restoration that, you know, I'm no expert in, and, you know, I'm not an engineer and I'm not quite as involved in those projects, but they are out there.
Very good. Wanted to ask you one other question about Rickard and Milky. And that is the fact that on your website it is proudly trumpeted that you are 100% employee-owned.
Mm-hmm.
Does that have any impact on the nature of the work that you do, or kind of how you feel about the work that you do?
I mean, I think it probably, you know, in a sense operates like any other company in the work that we do. But just being, you know, 100% employee-owned, I think people have a little bit more, you know, sense of a pride in that, like, you know, we're all company owners, so everything that we do, you know, it does affect everybody, and just like kind of have more of an important role, and you know, you kind of just know a little bit more about stuff.
Very good. Tiffany Wagner, she is an environmental scientist with Rickert and Mielke, a firm that is headquartered in Waukesha, but the scope of your operation is far broader than that. In fact, what are we talking about in terms of the scope of your operation?
So we have a couple offices here, one in Kenosha, Green Bay, Madison, and then more recently Iowa City. And so, you know, mostly work in the Midwest.
Very good. Also with us today is another friend of Kaylin Palomares's, Maddie Kammerer, who is a natural resources specialist at USDA Natural Resource Conservation Service. So tell us what is behind that imposing name.
Yeah, there's a lot of letters. There's a lot of acronyms too. So yeah, my kind of day-to-day is very different depending on the season and kind of depending on what program we are in, so to say. So with NRCS, the Natural Resource Conservation Service, there are kind of three main programs that we as an agency work on. So we work with a lot of farmers, private landowners, like forest landowners, a lot more recently like urban ag, so urban and small scale, kind of those homesteaders or even like community gardens in Milwaukee we've been working with. So we do a lot of work just trying to get these people and these private landowners to add more conservation onto their land, whether it be like a large farm implementing cover crops to kind of hold that soil in place, or like adding a grass waterway into a place where maybe they've had erosion issues before. And then even down to like on our small scale and urban farms, helping them get the resources to even start up having an urban farm and kind of get the money in their hands to people who really need it. And so as an agency, we do a lot of cost sharing. So we kind of will pay them based on practices that they're implementing if they do it up to our standards and specs. So yeah, we do like a lot of the major practices we do for these larger farms are like cover crops or having them add a third crop into their crop rotation to do kind of like a conservation crop rotation. And then like with the smaller scale, we can do high tunnels, which are essentially like a greenhouse to help them extend their growing season. It's a lot of agriculture-based practices, but then we do help with forest landowners too to kind of get them to help keep their forest healthy for the long run. Because a lot of times when you go out, like when I go out and visit these landowners, sometimes they're older gentlemen or older women who maybe they got this forest land passed down to them from like their grandparents. Mm-hmm. And so they want to kind of keep that forest healthy for their grandkids, for their children. And so it's always interesting to see the difference between people who own forests and people who own agriculture land. I mean, they obviously have very separate goals and very separate things that they're doing, but they all, it's cool to see all these people who have conservation goals in mind and being able to talk to them and kind of, if possible, get them cost share and help them out with that if they have like these huge projects in mind. So yeah, it's very different what I do since I do cover such a large part of the state. I go up all the way to Adams County, which is the Central Sands part of the state.
Wow.
And so that's where they grow a lot of our like vegetable crops, potatoes, all those kind of little trickier crops to grow down somewhere south like this. But then also being able to go to Milwaukee and go to urban gardens and see how they are using 10th of an acre to grow crops and support their community and take it to farmers markets and sell them. So it's very cool to see these different things. And I didn't come from a farming background. And so in a way, it kind of like hurts me a little, but also helps because I don't have that bias of coming from a farm. And so I don't necessarily think that, oh, you need to just grow corn every single year. I think that there's something good in growing corn, soy, and wheat. Like it's, you need to kind of expand what we thought farming was because it's changed so much, and we need to keep changing farming for it to be sustainable in the long run. So definitely interesting job.
Yeah. So are you in the business of persuasion, or
<No.
laughs> or when people come to you, or when you are first interacting with people, are they already persuaded of the importance of doing what you hope they will do?
Yeah, so a lot of the times the people who come to us, they typically already are implementing some form of conservation on their land. I mean, we do get people who come and maybe they've been having like a major soil erosion problem for years and they've been trying to just fix it through maybe tillage or usually it's just tillage. They're trying to kind of fix it through that. So they sometimes people kind of get to a dead end where the problem just keeps occurring year after year. And so they'll come to our office, and then we will go out, do a site visit, see what resource concerns we maybe are seeing. So let's say, like, yeah, like soil erosion, it's washing away every year because it's just bare soil. So then we can maybe suggest to them, oh, let's cut back on some of the tillage. This would help you out. We could do cover crops, kind of keep the soil green, have something green on the soil to hold it in, have living roots to keep the soil in place. So a lot of times people come to us with an issue that they are having, and they're just looking for options, because sometimes there's really not much that they can do unless they reach out to us. But we're, as an agency, non-regulatory, so we aren't going to punish anyone for having, let's say, erosion issues. We don't want people to feel bad about what they're doing, because, I mean, if they've been doing it for 30 years, you don't want to all of a sudden tell them that they've been doing it wrong. And mm-hmm. So it's kind of a soft approach, being like, well, what you're doing is working for you, but if you add this could improve your operation. And so with farming, it can be a little tricky. That's the person's livelihood is farming. A lot of times farmers don't have a second job. So you want to be very, very, like, kind to these people, because that's their life. So.
Sure. Well, and I should think another tricky matter is the fact that we've come to kind of new and deeper understanding about some of these issues.
Right.
And if somebody is working the family farm that's
right.
been in the farm in the family for several generations, you're in a sense suggesting that they start doing things differently from the way
yeah.
their father and grandfather
yeah.
and great-grandfather maybe did
yeah.
it. And so it sounds like there's a bit of psychology involved in the work that you do.
Yeah, so I definitely think that a position like this, you have to be good talking to people. You have to have kind of that customer service background. I don't think if you're a very introverted person, it would be a good job, because it can be tough conversations with people. I mean, yeah, this is their livelihood, and telling them to switch the way that they're doing things can be expensive. Equipment is expensive. A combine can run $500,000, and telling them, hey, maybe you should change the way you're doing that, that's a lot of money for them. And so being able to offer cost share is helpful. We do have like a ranking system that goes into place with our program, so we will go out and assess the resource concerns, bring it back to the office, and kind of see if they're meeting these resource concerns. So if they are like helping the erosion already, that's kind of a benefit to them. But then we have programs where we obviously want to help address those issues. So we rank all these applications, and not everybody will get selected, but since it is a voluntary program, it's kind of up to them if they do want to even like sign the contracts too. So then there is a lot of money though in our, since we are a federal agency, there's a lot of money that we do have available for people. So a lot of work.
So I was going to ask you how that whole matter of cost sharing
yeah.
works. So it sounds like you're in the business of maybe giving grants. I mean,
yeah,
is
so
that
yeah.
kind of the way this works?
Yeah,
I mean
they're essentially grants. They don't cover 100% of the cost. We do have higher cost share rates for kind of the historically underserved, socially disadvantaged individuals. So like beginning farmers. We, as for NRCS, it is race, ethnicity, and like beginning farmer status, but not gender. FSA, the Farm Service Agency, our sister agency, they're historically underserved. They also include gender in that. So for like those historically underserved producers, they can get a little higher cost share rate as well. But typically it's like 50 to 75% cost share that we will pay for them. We have a program where it's, let's say they're doing one large practice. Once they do that large practice, we will pay them on that. And then we have another program where it's a 5-year program where we will give them a yearly payment on top of any other practices that they implement. So two different programs, but still the conservation is the goal for both of them.
How would you compare what you do to what Tiffany was describing
yeah.
in terms of Rikert and Mielke? In what ways is what you do similar to what she does versus different?
Yeah, so obviously mine's a very heavy agriculture-based job, but we do have like soil scientists and wetland specialists on staff who do a lot of our kind of wetland delineating and wetland mapping in-house. But I know that I think we do go to some like private stuff for more of the larger wetland problems or like issues we're having. But we work with a lot of other kind of partner agencies and organizations. We work a lot with like Pheasants Forever and Ducks Unlimited. So we have biologists from them that we work with who come out and do like the large wetland restoration projects. So they'll help us kind of with the engineering and planning of those two. And so, yeah, as an agency, we don't actually like physically do any of the conservation work. We are doing all the planning and then the cost sharing for them. And so sometimes Ducks Unlimited and Pheasants Forever will be doing the more hands-on stuff. But
so you're more in the guidance business,
and
helping with the process of
right.
maybe underwriting things.
Mm-hmm.
So, Kaylin, in terms of the work with Racine County, would you have reason to intersect with what Maddie does?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. We work with NRCS all the time. I just haven't crossed paths with Maddie specifically yet. But what she's describing, all these conservation practices, generally landowners will reach out to us first, to the conservation division of the county that they're in. Every single county has a conservation staff who is a me or a Chad who, you know, you guys met or heard last month. So we generally are the ones getting reached out to first, not always, but generally. And then we get them started. We sign them up with all the paperwork, and then we kind of send that off to NRCS. So it's a lot of like, we do our part and then we hand it off, and I'm sure that it's the same for you guys. You do your part, you hand it off, and then the work gets done generally by a contractor, or like she said, sometimes like the Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited will do that physical work, and we do, we write up some reports afterwards, usually send it to NRCS, and then it's done. So I do work with NRCS a lot in my job as well, but especially again the agriculture part, which is not the main part of what I do, but it's part of what I do. So we're very well acquainted with the organization, so.
And the good work that they do.
Mm-hmm.
Maddie, I want to circle back to the matter of maps. So can you give us, you know, kind of a real world example of that map making piece of it, and the way in which doing that kind of thing would be helpful for a given project or a given client, if we want to call them that?
Yeah, so when we are going through the whole contracting process of creating the conservation plan for the client, we'll go out beforehand and do a site visit and kind of take, like, we'll take pictures, we'll go on site, ask questions, see where they're having problem spots, and so then we'll come back to the office and map that out, kind of where they're having those issues. And then from there, we have computer programs that can kind of give us guidance on, hey, this practice might be more helpful for that area because of that mm-hmm. issue. And then when we're a little further in the contracting phase, when we're like actually getting ready to like sign the documents and get everything to the producer for them to kind of go over and okay, we'll create maps for them. I usually, when I'm doing it, I'll make a couple different variations of a like mm-hmm. one project, so that way they can say, oh yeah, I do want to plant trees right there. I do want to put a pollinator garden right here. So I kind of use it in that sense of making the visuals for those people to kind of better understand where exactly we want them to be doing our practices.
Right. Very good.
Yeah.
Well, it's fascinating to hear about this whole world that, of course, most of the rest of us don't know anything about, and yet it's such incredibly important work, especially when it comes to matters like conserving some of our most precious resources. Kaylin, do you have anything you want to add?
I guess the only thing, I just keep thinking about the maps. The maps has been the topic of the day, but I have a minor in geography, but I didn't take any GIS courses, and I did a little bit of GIS work in some of my internships before I got a big girl job, I call it, and I would just suggest, like, to anyone potentially listening who is going to be going to Parkside, who is maybe inspired by these conversations, I highly recommend taking GIS courses if you're going into the environmental field, because they are so worthwhile. It's hard. The classes can be difficult, but once you get it, you get it, and it's very worth having that experience, and you will be looked at as worth more as you're applying for jobs if you have that experience, not just in school, but if you happen to ever work with it with an internship or a job. It just makes you look way better, and I wish that I had maybe taken at least a class, even if I didn't get the certificate in it or whatever. I wish I would have taken a class, because it would have kind of helped me feel less like an imposter in my job. So,
right. Well, and would help you do your work even better, would give
right.
you other tools.
And I'm learning. I use GIS a decent amount, and I'm using it more and more as I get more into my job. I'm still pretty fresh, but I can't recommend that enough, just to take some sort of GIS class, get some experience in that.
Very good. Well, it's great to hear about, first of all, your field of study, your experience at Parkside, and your experience out in the big, wider world. Tiffany Wagner, environmental scientist at Riekert & Mielke in Waukesha, and Maddie Kammerer, a natural resource specialist at USDA Natural Resource Conservation Service. Thank you both for making the trip to our studios to be a part of this conversation. And Kaylin Palomares, thank you for coming up with a really great idea and for being part of this as well.
Thanks, Greg.
And to finish out today's morning show, we want to tell you about a number of events that are happening here in southeastern Wisconsin over the next several weeks. Beginning with Hawthorne Hollow Nature Sanctuary and Arboretum, you can take advantage of these crystal clear winter evenings by visiting the Heidi Observatory. Every Wednesday evening is Wednesday Under the Stars, Thursday evenings Through the Lens, and Friday evenings are events called Small Eyes Under the Skies. Those are events designed for the whole family. And you can get more information about cost and registration at the website of Hawthorne Hollow. Ahoy Audubon is hosting an event on Saturday morning, January 25th, Ahoy Field Trip, Waterfowl and Gulls on the Kenosha Lakefront. That is 9 to 11 a.m., meeting at Southport Park. And a similar event is going to be taking place in Samuel Myers Park in Racine on Saturday, February 15th. Also, on February 6th, Thursday evening, Dave Giordano from Root Pike Wynn is going to be giving a presentation on Neumiller Woods in Summers. And that talk is going to be happening at Riverbend Nature Center. Again, Thursday evening, February 6th. Speaking of Riverbend Nature Center, they are hosting their Chilly Winter Evening and Candlelight Trails event on Friday, January 31st, 5 to 8 p.m. You are invited to walk the trails by candlelight with complimentary hot chocolate. And if you like, you can add a hearty chili dinner to the proceedings, either before or after the walk. Chili served straight from the campfire kettle. Advance tickets are not required, but they are recommended. For more information about that, you can go to riverbendracine.org. Richard Bong State Recreation Area is having a fun event this Saturday, January 18th, called Knee High Naturalist. You're invited to meet at Shelter One with your 3 to 5 year old youngsters and learn all about animal tracks. And on Saturday evening, February 8th, there's an event called Return to Romance, where you're invited to walk the trails, enjoy live music in the Visitor Center Auditorium, and have delicious, locally made treats. You do need to register to attend. The website for the Richard Bong State Recreation Area is actually found within the Wisconsin DNR website. That's dnr.wisconsin.gov. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on the morning show, we are looking forward to welcoming into our studios Bob Wirch, state senator from Kenosha. From WGTD's Arts and Other Events calendar, the UW Parkside Department of Literatures and Languages and the UWP Library invite all to attend a free 4-part community class titled Intellectual Curiosities, Reading the Iliad. I will be interviewing Dr. Dana Oswald, the teacher of the course, on this coming Tuesday's morning show. But in the meantime, you might want to go to uwp.edu for more information about this class in case it is something you would like to participate. The first class meeting will be on February 6th. Sunny skies today and a high of 36 degrees, overnight low of 23. Tomorrow's high 43 degrees and then sharply colder temperatures. This is WGTD.